Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
When Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
Hello, it's a Saturday episode today, and so things are a little bit different. As you know, Monday and Thursday, I do my hard-hitting, big culture war episodes, and on Saturday, sometimes I just chat, and sometimes I get interviews I've done with other people, because a lot of YouTubers don't necessarily have audio podcasts, so when they interview me for their shows, which many have been doing recently as I've done a bit of an online tour about The Psychology of Secrets, my book, My Adventures with Murderers, Cults and Influencers, which, by the way, at the moment has about 99% five-star reviews on Amazon, which is pretty cool. Please do add to that if you've read it, amazon.co.uk, that is, and Psychology of Secrets. So this is one I really enjoyed doing, and I'm not just saying that. It's actually a lot of fun. I think you'll agree once you've listened to it. And it was on the Vintage Read Show. So go and check that out on YouTube if you get to YouTube. And this is Shauna in Australia who is interviewing me. We cover everything from the Royals and Piers Morgan to Baby Reindeer, the idea of obsessive fans, cult Scientology and deception. And there's a bit of an insight into my life and my personality and all those things that Shauna has a great way of really getting to the person, getting to the personal as well. So yeah, as I say, go follow her on the Vintage Read Show, and please do get hold of that book. There'll be a link in the description, and I'll see you at the end.
Hi, and thanks for joining me for More to the Story. Today's special guest is Andrew Gold, creator of the Heretics YouTube channel and also the author of a fabulous new book called The Psychology of Secrets. Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a pleasure to be here, Shauna.
Thank you. Now, I noticed that you were on Piers Morgan last night, and I just wanted to ask you, what was that experience like?
It was cool. The only thing is, the only thing is you don't get much time with him. It's sort of almost like they've worked it out to be almost like a factory conveyor belt. You get there and he's already on doing something else, and you're with the other guests in a little room, and it's all a bit awkward because you and the other guests are going to be disagreeing. So you're just sort of standing there shiftily, and then you get pushed into the room and he's sort of looking down and writing and stuff, and he's quite busy. So, and you can tell like the other, you know, we're all there to sort of suck up a bit because he's the big star and it's like quite exciting, but then it's like you start and you're on and suddenly it's all like quick and going. And then it's a scary experience because they go, and I've heard like soccer football pundits talk about this when they have to analyze a game, because like the first person says something about like a particular goal, then the second and then the third, and then you're the fourth and you've got to find something original to say that hasn't already been said. So that constant panic is going on. Suddenly the whole 40 minutes is gone. I've been called stupid and nonsense and stuff like that. And then you're sort of shifted out the room. And then, you know, by the time you've had a moment to think about what's going on, you're on the train back to wherever I happen to live, a couple of hours away, thinking, gosh, did I say the right stuff? But yeah, really, really cool. And I'm just glad that there are people like Piers who are out there and very big and well-known and famous, despite saying things that run counter to the current orthodoxy, the current narrative in society.
Yeah, I actually thought you did really well because you got some really good sound bites in there. And
thank you.
Yeah, I think it would be so hard because it's so rushed. And yeah, so I thought it was great. Do you still get nervous when you have to do anything?
Yeah, really nervous. I remember there's a comedian called Lee Evans who he was very popular in like the 90s and 2000s. He was in a few films as well, like Something About Mary. And I remember him saying he used to vomit backstage before going on every time, even after he'd been doing it for years. So I just try to tell myself that that's a sign that things are going well, that you know, there's nothing wrong. If I'm ever not nervous, maybe there's something wrong. I moderated a conversation in front of people, which I never do. I'm always in front of this little camera I've got here. But the other day in New York for Dissident Dialogues, which is what Winston Marshall, the Mumford and Sons, the guy who left Mumford and Sons, he put that on. And there's Richard Dawkins there, and there's all these like big famous people, and I've got to suddenly sit there and do a thing. And I was petrified backstage. But, you know, you go on and you try and tell a couple of jokes, which makes you even more nervous, but then it starts to go okay. But you still get nervous, and there's just like a mad, everything just goes so quickly because of the nerves, and then you're sort of out of it and you're like, whew, and then you sort of wish you were on for longer. So it's a whole thing.
Yeah, just when you settle in, it finishes. Yeah, I can imagine that. I wanted to actually say that the introduction of your book is compelling, it's thrilling, and it's just a little tad gory. And I wondered if you would mind telling everyone viewing a little bit about Melissa, just as much as you want to share, because I don't want to do spoilers. And then I've got some follow-up questions.
Okay, sure. And let me just say, I love your channel. I think it's so wonderful that you've managed to have a channel that is predominantly about books that has become so popular, you know, because we're losing it. So thank you for doing this channel. It's just a beautiful thing. And, you know, I've used it before to quote things you've said about Meghan and Harry and stuff. So thank you. Melissa was a person, or is a person, that I knew who works in the sort of media world, who one day sent me a WhatsApp message. I didn't know her very well at all. I'd hardly met her. And her message revealed that she'd, and I suppose it's the first line of the book, so it's not too much of a spoiler, but that she had, through some quirk of circumstance, become a murderer. Now, whether she's actually a murderer, whether that's the right term, is up for debate. But she did something that she believes makes her a murderer, and that's the point. And the point was, though, why did she tell me this? What compelled her to tell me? She said she hadn't told anybody else in the world ever. This was a huge secret for her, and one that could have, in her mind, ruined her career, got her in all sorts of trouble, particularly with the police. So why tell me what compelled her to do so? And that's what led me on this sort of wild goose chase of trying to understand what secrets are.
Do you think that if someone tells you a secret, that you're more likely to believe it's true?
If they say that they're telling me a secret.
Yeah. So if someone comes up and says, oh, you know, I'm telling you something I've never told anyone else ever, I think you're more likely to believe it's true.
Yeah, you're definitely primed
to.
Well, I am. Yeah. I think that's to do with, I mean, one of the sort of positive aspects, one of the positive results in telling someone your secret is that it can increase the bond and the social cohesion between you and the person telling it, or you and the person you're telling it to. This is something we definitely get with, I mean, it's not something we should do too often, I suppose, but gossiping about other people or gossiping about another mutual friend. The bad side is you have feelings of guilt because you've spoken about that friend or whatever it might be, but it definitely increases that bond whenever you tell someone a secret. We all like to feel that somebody is wants to be closer to us and wants to have a bond with us. So I think we are primed, as you say, to want to believe whatever they tell us. Oh, we've got this big secret. Oh, tell me, I want to, especially if somebody who you admire and look up to. If Richard Dawkins comes up to me and says, hey, I've got a bit of a secret here that I'm only going to tell you, I'm going to be so excited by being able to share something unique with Richard Dawkins or whoever it might be that, yeah, I'm definitely primed to believe it more.
That's really interesting what you just said, because you're more or less saying that the social status of someone or professional status of anybody that tells you a secret impacts the value of the secret to you.
Yeah, I think that's, so. And I think there's definitely, I mean, that's part of why people tell their secrets to me, I think, just because I'm a podcaster. And I think by virtue of being a podcaster, you have a certain ranking, or I don't know what, people will look up to that as a status, isn't it? And so you look up to that status, and you want to confide, you want to be involved with that person, you want that person to notice you. Whenever I've spoken to people who I look up to, So Richard Dawkins is a good example. I mean, I did speak to him and I said to him that I'd read his book in the bath with bath bombs going on. And I don't know what I really wanted to get out of that because he doesn't really get involved in sort of jocular discussions. So he was just like, oh, right. Yes. Okay. Yes. And so, but why did I tell him that? And I think
he
it's
might
just
have thought you were flirting with him or something.
He might have done. You should see the amount of women that go up to him at these conferences because we were all in the sort of backstage area, and you sort of congregate as the sort of VIP thing, and all the women go over to him. He ends up with like a queue of women. He's 83, this man, but he loves it. I think. I don't know. I don't want to speak for him. He's very very serious, so I shouldn't joke. But he has a sense of humor as well. But the point being that you look up to people. You have this thing called parasocial interaction, which I go into in the book as well. And parasocial interaction is just when we started talking about this in the 1950s when talk show hosts sort of spoke to the audience as though they were their friends. And we had that feeling of friendship. And then sometimes you had stalkers and you had these things called stans now, which comes from the Eminem song Stan about a stalker. And now people talk about that with pride. I stan him. I am a stan of this person. So parasocial interaction was a big part of it. You have this weird faux friendship. And in more recent years, we have what I think I've coined. I don't know. It's really something to say you've coined something. But parasocial reciprocal interaction, because finally we can actually speak back, which is such a pleasure, but it increases that bond even more so that we're all sort of mates and we're all friends. And so people do want to come to us and reveal all their secrets, especially because they don't have the bad consequences or the negative consequence of me telling their friends, for example. That's not going to happen. So there's no risk.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Have you managed to see Baby Reindeer yet on Netflix?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it ties into what you just said then so beautifully.
Because, when does this come out, this episode? Sorry.
I think it's out in Australia. I mean,
no, your one. This episode we're doing now.
Oh, Sunday.
Sunday, okay. I think I'm all right to say that I can't say where, but I saw her being interviewed somewhere. Anyway, go on.
Oh, well, because it ties in with what you're saying, but I think the fascinating thing is that you don't even need to be sort of a YouTuber or a creator or anything to get stalked. I mean, that series shows that you can just be in a pub serving someone and you can end up getting stalked, which I thought was quite comforting. We're all equally in danger.
Yes. And well, that's true, actually. And I did think if that person was, the baby reindeer person was around, I think it's just as dangerous for a celebrity to encounter her or for just like anybody to just encounter her. If she takes a shining to you, you are screwed.
And what
if it's
you?
True.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, yeah, true. What about you with stans? Have you got any obsessive fans?
Just one called Shauna. I can't say much more about that. No. Have I got obsessive fans? Not too many.
She just won't get out of your DMs.
Well, she won't. No, you know what? I've turned off like all the DMs and things. I had to. And it's such a shame because when I started, you know, I'm sure it's the same for you at the beginning. You start and it's so wonderful, that very first viewer you have, that very first listener, the first person to get in touch. And then for days and days, you're just absolutely flabbergasted. You're looking at this thing and it's like, this person listened to my work I put out into the internet. And they're, I cannot believe it. And they're saying things. Oh no, somebody's just said something horrible to me. Okay, but the other ones are nice. And you get that and you try and reply to every single comment. And eventually you find, gosh, you know, I've spent 20 hours today replying to messages and only 4 hours sleeping and 0 hours actually working on the YouTube channel. There are occasional times where people are really upset that I haven't replied to them. Some people think I go around deleting their messages. I've never deleted a single comment on YouTube ever because I just don't see the point. But I'm constantly being accused of doing so. And they say, it's like, I thought we were friends and you've deleted my comment. I'm not deleting the comments. And then sometimes there have been people who have been so lovely and so nice, and then they've asked for, say, my address because they want to send me some chocolates. And I've always said I can't do that. And that's where the parasocial interaction or the reciprocal interaction sort of fails, because we act like we're friends. And I, for all intents and purposes, that's a very enjoyable thing, not just for them, but for me. I love that. But also, it wouldn't be very fair on my fiance if I were to start giving out our address. But then what am I implying? You know, oh, I think you might send me anthrax. Well, You know, how can we be friends if I think you're going to send me poison in the post, which I don't really think they're going to do. I think there's a 0.1% chance of that. But if I give it out 1,000 times, that means that it will happen. So, yeah.
Well, have you got any? Responsible. I mean, you're just being responsible, aren't you? And realistic, yeah. Really. Yeah. But I get what you're saying. Now, I want to get into chapter one, because you talk about Nazi Germany and you talk about that sort of boiling the frog, sort of rolling out of propaganda, and the fact that sort of human rights and dignity were slowly taken away, and it was this slow erosion. And I wondered whether you think there's any parallels with what's happening with the university protests, in that I got, you know, sort of a real visceral reaction when I saw a Jewish student being stopped from going into his building in his university. Just a barricade was put up. He was Jewish, just a student, and he was prevented from entering. And I don't really know anything about the politics of the situation, but to me that just felt wrong. Mm. So can you see any parallels with the propaganda issue? Do you think or am I overblowing the whole thing?
No, you're not overblowing. It's the single most complicated thing in the world, and it's so hard to unpack that I don't even know the answer. I say I don't even know. Even the Jewish man doesn't know. I don't even know the answer to that. There are people who say, listen, this isn't actually about anti-Semitism. This is about Marxism. This is a new Marxism. Ultimately, what we've got is oppressed versus oppressor narratives. So you've got particular places where they are, they identify more as oppressed historically. So Ireland is one place where they are particularly pro-Palestine, anti-Israel. It's also a place where, as a Jewish person, it's not necessarily that safe to be. A lot of Irish friends of mine attest to that. So you've got that oppressor versus oppressed narrative, and it's such an overly simplistic one, because it speaks to this idea that there are good guys and bad guys in the world. Really, okay, 1% of the world are psychopaths, but no country is just going to be purely evil, particularly the only one in the Middle East that is a full democracy, that has full rights for gay people, for example. So when you see gays for Gaza, it is quite extraordinary. At the same time, I suppose they would say, what, should we just let all these people die just because they're homophobic? You know, I think that's a valid point to make. So these things are all really, really complicated. I wonder to what extent it's anti-Jewish, and to what extent, okay, Marxist, and then maybe you can say, well, that's also anti-Semitic. Those kinds of philosophies lead to being anti-Semitic, because there is a feeling, whether they admit to this or not, that Jewish people are more privileged than others. And let's be honest about this. There are, and I know I'll probably get in trouble with my own community for saying this, there are a disproportionate number of Jewish people in high positions. Well, that's something that should be applauded. There are also a lot of Asian people who do particularly well. People from minorities have to fight tooth and nail when they get to a country. They try to assimilate. They try to, as much as possible, get involved in institutions and rise up, because they feel that's the only way to remain safe if you've been oppressed that many times. So that's the true oppression, and you should then fight rather than just say victimhood. So it's really, really complicated. And once you adhere to an ideology that says that some people are more oppressed than others, that we should raise those people up and not others, I think you're always going to end up with Jews on the outside, but also a lot of gay people are now finding that they're ousted for not having the right views. The Jewish people who were not let into the university, we don't know the full stories of that. Is it because they were Jewish? Is it because they were Zionist? Is it because they espoused views that were pro-Israel off camera, or whatever it might be? I would say to that is still anti-Semitic. I know a lot of people disagree with that, but there's no other country in the world that we question its right to exist. I've never heard that. No matter how many awful things we've heard coming out of Saudi Arabia, no matter how many awful things coming out of Pakistan. Pakistan was made, I think, the year after Israel, in just as contentious start beginnings. And has been doing awful things, even in the last few years, ousting Afghani peoples, just throwing them out the country, that kind of thing. I've never heard somebody say Pakistan shouldn't exist. And Zionism, in my understanding of it, is the belief that the Jewish people have a right to have a country. It's one tiny country. It's the size of Wales. It's absolutely tiny. It's mostly desert. and there's just a few people there, basically. It's surrounded by about 50 Muslim states. America is a Christian state that is absolutely enormous. That the one tiny Jewish state is constantly called into question is in my, if, when others are not, that is what I believe is anti-Semitic. It's the exceptionalism. So yeah, very, very complicated. I believe these people don't feel like they hate Jews. I think it is a political thing. And I think it's a horrible political Marxist thing that's going on.
Yeah.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in four of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, two carry on sizes, two checked sizes, four colours, black, blue, pink. Grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded. Both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favourite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
In your book too, you made the really good point that I didn't even know this, but you said that a lot of people didn't stand up against Hitler because they thought he was trying to restore order. Mm. And I didn't even know that. Like, I had never come across that before. And I sort of realized that on these university protests that a lot of faculty members, under the guise of restoring order, were actually preventing Jewish students from entering buildings. And it just really sort of, because I just read your book, you know, I found it a really stark sort of parallel there. I want to get on to, you really have done amazing research in this book, and you teach people a lot about secrets, particularly that there's three categories, moral, relational, and aspirational. And some secrets apply to all three, some don't. And I love the way you used Oscar Wilde to illustrate your point. But you also used your dad. And I was wondering if you'd mind telling the story of your dad, just to humiliate him some more.
He'll hate that. You know, the lawyers go through your book. You have to get everything fact-checked, and then the lawyers go through it. And one of the things they said was, can you make sure that your dad is okay with this? He's not going to sue us or anything. So I had to, like, ask him, you know this is going in the book, you're okay. And he was like, oh, for God's sake. I mean, he's, to an extent, become used to this, that I just... humiliate him habitually. This was a point about, and it's something Wilde said actually, which is, and I always get quotes wrong, I can't remember quotes, but something like, a secret can elevate the mundane to the sublime, or something like that. It's like, if something really boring, if you make it a secret, can seem fascinating. And it can stick in your mind. And so one of my earliest ever memories was walking into my dad's bedroom, and he was sat in a chair with silver leaves and things in his hair, or foil or whatever it is, and was getting his hair dyed. And all I remember though was the look on his face as I'd opened the door, and he was going, no, shut the door, you know, don't look at me, or something like that. And I described it as Medusa on fire in the book, because that's what he looked like. Like, you look at him, he turned to stone.
You could see it.
Yeah. You see it. You see the glint in the foil. But yeah, the point is, what a boring thing. My dad was dyeing his hair. Who cares, right? And that has stayed as this like etched memory in my mind because his reaction showed me this was a secret, that it must transgress some societal norm about which I don't know. And wow, what else can you do with secrets then?
Yeah. And I love the quote from the book where you said, now it's 30 years later and it's in a book. Hi, Dad.
Yeah, he hates it. He hates it. But what can you do?
He must be really proud of you, is he?
Yeah. He is. You know, but you know what it is, you know, you grow up wanting your parents to be proud all the time. And then when they are, because you're a sort of kid, even when you're in your mid-30s, whatever age you are, you're a kid, you're like, yeah, whatever. You know, you want it desperately and then you get it. You're like, yeah, cool, who cares? Yeah, next thing. What's next?
Yeah, downplay it. Yeah. You said that the secrets create the gossip that glues us together and tears us apart. And I immediately thought of the royal family.
Oh, yes.
Because it is all gossip, isn't it?
Yeah, well, without the gossip, they're nothing.
Yeah. And it does glue the whole thing together because particularly since the Harry and Meghan thing, it's become so much more fascinating for everybody and yet has become such a divisive issue.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really powerful quote from your book.
Oh, well, you know, when we were in tribes and things, they say that we used to sort of groom one another, picking nits out of our hair or whatever it was, licking our hair. I don't know what grooming entailed back then, evolutionarily. But then the tribes got too large. They went from like 80 to 150 or something. And it was just too time consuming to keep bonding through that kind of thing. It was, you know, and it was hard to do in threes or fours. It was mostly like a two-person thing. And so I think this is Robin Dunbar who posits this, but that we started to really bond through gossip. That was the thing that glued us together. So if that's been going on for 300,000 years, it makes sense that the biggest, most powerful, influential people in our tribes today are those who cause us to gossip about them, whether that's Kim Kardashian or whether that's the royals. If you don't look at the royals, it's that kind of mythological thing where they sort of disappear when you don't look at them. They need to be looked at. So they've got this tough battle to keep their secrets just out of the sense of dignity and pride, right? They don't want everybody knowing everything. They don't want Harry writing a book that reveals what Prince Charles does or King Charles does in his underwear. At the same time, without that, they don't have us watching them all the time, and they sort of disappear if we don't watch them.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, you quoted a truth purist, Sam Harris, who claimed that it was never okay to lie, right? Yeah. And you said that almost half of all lies are told by just 5% of the people, which just blew me away. I couldn't believe that. And I wonder, are you part of the 95% or the 5%?
It's such a boring thing to say, but I'm part of the 95%. And only because I go bright red if I lie. I'm one of those people. I think there's a lot of us. And I think these are ways to stop us lying. I mean, I'm obsessed with tribes and things and how we grew up. It sort of makes sense to me. And these are only theories we have to go on, but it really makes sense to me. And I think if you had a tribe where everybody was just lying all the time and they suffered no ill consequences, then they wouldn't survive because they would all be stealing from one another. They would all be hiding things. They would all be taking the best shelter without telling anyone else where it was. It couldn't possibly function. And so it seems like we've got these biological elements that prevent us from lying all the time or dissuade us from doing so. And so when I do lie, sometimes when I even tell the truth, you must know that feeling. You're like, I'm being honest here, but you've gone bright red. Yeah. But we do have these things that sort of say to us, hey, if you lie too much, people are going to realize and you're going to be kicked out of the tribe. You went red that time. You blushed everywhere. They're cottoning on to you. So be careful. Try to tell the truth whenever you can. And I think that over a period of hundreds of thousands of years has led to most of us being honest most of the time. We are extremely honest people. It seems like everyone's lying all the time, but that's only because when people do lie, it makes headlines. When politicians lie, it's the headline. And those are the things we remember. But most of us are are quite honest, and I'm honest. But why am I honest? Not because I'm such a great guy, but because I know I'm going to be caught out and that'll be terribly embarrassing. Lying is so embarrassing. Being caught lying, oh, horrible thing.
Yeah, it is. Are you one of those people that when you go through airport security, you look guilty?
Yeah.
Even though, yeah, of course. You know, you just, and you try to sort of not look guilty.
Well, you're getting intrusive thoughts, aren't you, at that point? You're going, what should I say? There's a bomb, or there's a bomb in my shoe. You don't, you know, so you just got to be, I just say to myself, just don't say anything. Keep walking. You haven't done anything wrong.
Have you ever told a lie, though, to get a professional opportunity or to get an interview, just say what someone wants to hear to get them to come on your show or anything like that?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, little lies like that. I can't even think of any just to hand, but I would just be shocked if I haven't done that because everybody does it. Yes. Just despite saying everybody's honest, I think these little exaggerations are very different. There are pro-social lies as well, which are basically white lies that we tell to sort of, yeah, you look great, you know, that kind of thing that you say to someone else.
Yeah,
But of course, like, you know, especially when you're starting out knowing that you're like 21 years old, there are no jobs. The jobs that are there are like minimum wage. And even the minimum wage ones seem to be asking you for qualifications you couldn't possibly have at 21 years old. And you know for a fact, because you've spoken to your friends, that their CVs or their resumes are exaggerated. So you know that you're going to, just to get a foot in the door, you have to. I wouldn't judge that kind of exaggerating. I would call it more than lies, just because you've got to have that opportunity. You've got to get your foot in the door. And it's so hard at that age. Now, once you get to a point where you're happy with where your career's at, I don't think you have to do it anymore, you know? So that's a luxury. Again, it's a luxury. You know, someone who's impoverished might have to steal to live. And then they get tarred not only with being poor and having this impoverished life, but now they're a liar and they're a thief. Whereas somebody who's wealthy has the luxury of not having to even consider whether they need to steal or not, and then gets to have this morally pure outlook. So a lot of lying and deception is about necessity, I think, as well.
You've got a second book in you. Because you just said that not lying is a luxury, which was a great line.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I've started a new book. I started writing a book called The Unintended Bigot, Chronicles of a Cancelled YouTuber.
Wow. That will go. Yeah, that's great.
I hope so.
Yeah. So you distributed a survey about secret habits that people have, and to get data and get information, and you distributed to your friends and family and also some of your audience, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, how did you decide on those questions? Were they to do with your secret habits, or how did you sort of hit on them?
Yeah, well, it was that. It was that. And also because there are things people don't talk about. There are things that people make a fuss about not talking about, which is included. So stuff about masturbation or whatever it might be there. But there's also stuff that even those people don't want to talk about, which is like nose picking, right? Yeah. Isn't it funny, like the levels, you think that the worst thing is sex, but people do talk about sex all the time. We did on Piers Morgan last night, and Madonna, what she was up to with her hand and what she's getting her assistants to do and all those kinds of things. So we
Your
do
James
actually talk
Blunt
about that.
James Blunt line was funny.
Well, you know why? One of the reasons I mentioned James Blunt is because he's the most likely to retweet it, because he's quite, he's really funny with his tweets.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so I thought I'll go with James Blunt. But for anyone who didn't watch, it was to do, you know, the stuff that Madonna gets up to. Would it be okay if James Blunt did it on stage?
It's funny.
But just singing, "You're beautiful, it's true," while he's up to whatever he's doing. But what was my point, actually? What was I saying about James? No, I don't know. Do you remember what was
about the secret habit survey and deciding on questions?
People pick their noses. And one person that I put in the book is a friend of mine who told me the story while I was writing it, which is brilliant, which was that. And I think it's brilliant because we all relate. It's not because I want to say this guy is an idiot on his own. It's like we've all been there, which is he was picking his nose. He must have been 11, 12 years old. He's in the car and they were in traffic. And he just had his finger right up there in the back of the car. And out the window, he suddenly realized there were three girls about his age who were looking and pointing at him. No. And that's just the most horrific thing. And I think when you hear that story, you don't go, "Oh, what a weirdo, he was picking his nose." You just go, "Oh, how unfortunate," because everyone does it. And it's something nobody's supposed to talk about. And I think that's the problem we have in society today, is that we give these things more power by virtue of keeping them secret. So just, you know, and these should just be private matters, does this person pick the nose? Do they not? But the fact that it transgresses as a societal norm, you're not supposed to do it. You're supposed to never put your finger anywhere near there or whatever. You only use a tissue or something in the bathroom or whatever, makes it a secret, which I think it's sad, although I don't really want, it's not that I want a society where everybody's just picking their nose in public. I find that quite disgusting. But that's the idea of the survey was to show like, hey, we're all like that. We have a tendency towards, I don't know if it's a Victorian thing, but particularly in the West, pretending that we don't have bodily functions, pretending that we don't do these things, we don't fart, we don't poop, we don't do these things. Sort of pretend we're almost apart from the rest of the animal kingdom. That's the intent here. And I wanted to sort of get us back to basics and say, well, hang on, you know, because I don't want us to feel shame around these things.
Yeah, I think it's great. And did any of your family and friends feel real fear that you're able to determine which was which just from their answers?
So it was this anonymous Google survey where I couldn't tell who anyone was, but the way it works is there's like a whole page, so I can see each individual's entire page of answers. So if there was one of them that was like, my secret was such and such, and I knew that secret about them, I would know that that's them and I'd know the rest of their answers.
Yes.
But I don't, I don't think there was anyone like that exactly. What I do know is that I think every man who answered the quiz, the test, the survey, said that they masturbate. And I know that quite a few family members of mine answered that test. But, you know, we know that. We know that everybody does it. We know that every man does it. But nobody wants, we want to imagine our parents and our cousins and our brothers and our, you know, they exist in some sort of cartoonish world outside of that. So it being confronted with that, once that idea popped into my head, was rather disconcerting.
Traumatic.
It was traumatic just to think about. It's what Jerry Seinfeld says, I think. I think it was like, you know, or maybe it was something that I think it was him. But like, you don't want to think of your parents having had sex. You don't want them ever to have done it. But I think it's also very sad, the idea that they don't have sex or never had sex or anything like that. That's sad. So we're caught in between this kind of weird societal thing where it's horrible that your parents do it and you don't want to imagine it. But the real secret would be, hey, you know, their parents, they haven't had sex in 30 years. That's more of a secret. So
exactly. You would be familiar with that term if I tell you I'll have to kill you, right? And I would imagine that being a recipient of many secrets through the course of your career, have you ever felt like, actually, more to that, say you interviewed someone and they told you something. Have they ever contacted you later and said, edit that out, get rid of that, I don't want it out there? Or have you ever had any real pushback?
There have been a couple of times where people have said things that they thought might be controversial. And they've said, do you mind just taking that out? That hasn't happened in a while. And I think I would push back now because that's the whole point of the interview. And if you're having an interview that, you know, later we're taking things out that were actually interesting and juicy and surprising and controversial, well, what's the point, you know? And now with Heretics, I spend money on that, like a lot. Heretics costs like £8,000 a month to run now, which is like US dollars and more Australian dollars. So each video now is more and more important in that sense because it doesn't make that money back. So You do your YouTube, you get these people in, and if they were to then come back and say like, hey, that really juicy bit, that's quite controversial, I don't want it in there, I think now I would say, it hasn't happened yet. There has been, I mean, one celebrity, it was going through his lawyers, and the lawyers, they took out loads of stuff. They kept coming back and saying, we want this out, we want that out, and it was like, great, was there any point in doing this? And that was unfortunate because the celebrity in question, I think, was actually fine with it all, and he or she was apologetic and saying, I'm sorry, I didn't realize they would be doing all this stuff, but such is life. But secrets like that, there haven't been too many. I think people know not to say, you know, it tends to be more like, I said the wrong name with this person, or I'm not sure that's true what I said, can you just double check it? That kind of thing.
Yeah, not to give too much away about the book, but you illustrate that quite a few times throughout the book, that heartbreaking story about the two boys that actually take the day off from an orphanage or escape from an orphanage, and something happens, which I won't give away. You've got to get the book, guys. It's really good. But, you illustrate that point, that some people are so frightened that their secrets will come out, that it even means a tragedy happens. And you sort of, you illustrate that really, really well in the book. I want to get on to, actually, you said one of the most profound things. You quote
get
all
out of
these
here.
Experts. You do, you did. You quote all these experts, you give us all this data, but you said something. You said the worst secrets in the world need to be tied up in its keeper's identity, something that defined them as a person that couldn't be shown to the world. That's really profound, and it sums it up, doesn't it? Exactly how much weight some secrets have. And that they can lead to people getting killed to stop secrets coming out.
That identity thing is so big, and I'm starting to think about how it touches everything that we're involved in. I think even outside of secrets, you look at identity. I mean, those people who are marching on university campuses, this is about their identity. They identify as and with what they perceive to be the oppressed, and that's all that matters. I was thinking back, because we were speaking about that earlier, and I know a lot of comments will be saying, because they always do, they say, oh, you don't care about Gaza and dead babies and things like that. And, you know, it's a point worth making. I mean, of course I do. It's horrible to watch what has happened to those people, and it's a horrifying feature of war. And there was a great Coleman Hughes on Joe Rogan bit the other day where he got the stats out and said that the casualties of civilians is far lower in Palestine than it was when the US invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, like significantly lower. That doesn't mean we don't mourn every single civilian killed, but it's lower even given that the US didn't have to face what the Gazans are doing, which is building, what Hamas is doing by building tunnels underground and beneath hospitals and things like that. It's almost impossible. So as with America, I mean, nobody called America genocidal. Maybe they did, genocidal or whatever. But look, when things tie in with your identity, we reach for words like genocide. We reach for these kinds of words, and we start to dehumanize the other. Really, we should care about life on all sides, but humans find that really hard. That's identity for you. And if you identify as something, as Alan Turing did, he identified, of course, his identity was wrapped up in being gay in a time where that was not allowed, which is just a horrible thing for him. And that would have been the worst kind of secret to keep. You know, it's not just a secret about someone else or something you did. It's about who you are. And that's just having to keep that secret and then having to be chemically castrated after it was found out. And, you know, it was we believe he took his own life, but no one's entirely sure. Just horrific. I think, as you're alluding to, that chapter, that's the most controversial chapter I've ever written about anything, because I go and meet, you know, a 25-year-old woman who has an attraction. And, you know, I don't mind giving away bits, because I just think some people aren't going to read the book. I hope people do. But they've come here to listen to me babbling on about stuff. So they deserve to get some snippets. And it was a 25-year-old woman in a village in Germany who has an attraction for children. This is not the same as Alan Turing. This is not an attraction that should, I don't know, I don't believe it should merit respect in a democratic society. I don't think it's something that she should ever engage in, but she says she hasn't ever done and never would. And she has to live with that and keep it secret. So whether she as a person is immoral or disgusting or despicable or whatever one might think of her, the fact is she has these urges and she has to keep them secret from pretty much everybody ever, except her mum and me.
Yeah.
So that was fascinating for me to meet her, and a difficult time too.
This podcast is supported by Progressive, a leader in RV insurance. RVs are for sharing adventures with family, friends, and even your pets. So if you bring your cats and dogs along for the ride, you'll want Progressive RV insurance. They protect your cats and dogs like family by offering up to $1,000 in optional coverage for vet bills in case of an RV accident, making it a great companion for the responsible pet owner who loves to travel. See Progressive's other benefits and more when you quote RV insurance at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Pet injury is an additional coverage and subject to policy terms.
This episode is brought to you by Experian. Are you paying for subscriptions you don't use, but can't find the time or energy to cancel them? Experian could cancel unwanted subscriptions for you, saving you an average of $270 per year and plenty of time. Download the Experian app. Results will vary. Not all subscriptions are eligible. Savings are not guaranteed. Paid membership with connected payment account required.
That was really compelling in the book, the way you wrote that. I felt like I was walking along with you when you walked back to the train station with her, and you really, I could tell you were exhausted because you have to suspend how you feel. You have to sort of replace revulsion with curiosity, which, you know, you're a journalist, so that's what you do. But I could just feel your exhaustion and the and your desperate attempt to find some sort of normalcy with her, you know, when you were walking back and you and she almost resented you trying to make her more human in that way. You know, she wanted to cling on to this identity of this bad person that needed to be contained and controlled. It was really a powerful, powerful part of your book. It really was.
Thank you.
And I also was fascinated to see about the No Offend organization in Berlin, where they don't have mandatory reporting, which I found fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, I think on the balance of probabilities, it's a net good. But it's such a difficult one, and it gets so many emotions involved. And I think the first thing to say whenever I introduce that topic, because it's so sensitive, is that nobody should, and it's such an obvious thing to say, but I still have to say it because people will sometimes willfully misinterpret, but no adult should ever, 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 ever be involved in anything of any sexual nature with a child or touching inappropriately. It can be the worst thing ever to happen to a child, and that needs to be eradicated from society. So that's the first thing to go in with. Then you go, okay, now we all agree on that. What is the best way to curb offending? And at the moment, what we do is we lock up offenders once they've been caught, which is most of the time they're not even caught. No one knows. Most of the time it's somebody's family member. Nobody even knows what's happened. But when they are caught, they go to prison for what, a couple of years, a few years, back out again, offend again, get another few people. So what don't offend do, or kein Täter werden in German, is they're looking at it from the other side. And they get a lot of, well, they don't actually get that much flack for this. I think a lot of people in Germany are on side with it. But their idea is they don't have mandatory reporting because they think it's the only way to get these people who have the attraction into therapy. Now, in the US and Australia, a doctor who doesn't report these people, if they come in and say what they're up, you know, what they're beliefs are, or their conditions or their attractions, that doctor will go to prison, which is extraordinary. In the UK, the doctor will lose their job, will be struck off, can't be a doctor anymore. So doctors who might want to help these people not to offend are incentivized to just report them to authorities. Who knows what will happen to them next. In Germany, they basically say to these people, look, come in, it's anonymous. You don't ever give us your name or anything like that, and we'll have a conversation. And the way they work with them is to disabuse them of cognitive biases that they might have. And the main one is it doesn't hurt children when we do this. They actually like it. That's what, you know, and if you think about it, if you just say to these people who haven't offended, who have never touched another person, you know, in that way, have never looked at the stuff online or anything like that, if you say to them, yes, but you're a monster anyway, well, you might feel better about yourself. It might feel good to tell these, and maybe they are monsters, who knows? But all that's going to happen is they're going to revert to the dark corners of the internet, where there are other dark people who have also been pushed to the sides, who will start finding bits of spurious evidence that seem to prove their point, and they will all tell one another, oh, well, it happened to me when I was a kid and I was fine. It's actually fine to do it. It's just the mainstream media who doesn't want you doing it, that kind of thing. Well, instead, the German clinic, they bring people in. They get them to come in and talk, and they really make these people understand, like, you know, we're not judging you, we're not doing this or that, we're just saying to you, you must never touch a child, you must never do anything, because it ruins lives, and we can help you with that. And if that curbs offense rates, then that's the best thing in the world. If it even means one fewer child is actually taken, or, you know, that's the best thing I've ever heard of. Now, unfortunately, because it's all anonymous, they don't have any way to track whether or not it's actually efficient. So all they have is the theory, which is if we get these people to actually come in and talk, they're less like, we believe they're less likely to offend, and that will save some children. I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah. I wanted to finish up with cults, because you are the cult expert. But in your book, you tie it in, particularly with Scientology, that the higher levels rely on secrecy for them to have any value. And I just wanted to ask you, just to finish up with, do you think Scientology is less powerful now? Do you think that all these sort of revelations have had an impact?
Yeah, 100%. They're supposed to be down to 20 to 30,000 members now. They claim they have millions. Yeah, it's really quite small. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, your YouTube's probably, how many subscribers have you got? It's probably more than Scientology has.
68.
Yeah, well, you've got double the number of followers that Scientology has. You probably have, yay, I don't know this, but you probably have less money than they do, fewer resources, because they've got millions and millions and millions, Tom Cruise money, wealthy benefactors all around the world. So they've got a lot of money. I went recently to Clearwater with Aaron Smith Levin from Growing Up in Scientology, where he lives, and that's the headquarters of Scientology. And he took me around the center, and it's just these beautiful, beautiful buildings, which are all just co-opted by Scientology. If shop frontages that are just fake, because actually it's just Scientology buildings now. And I don't think people would be happy if they knew. So they've got these fake shop frontages and facades and things. It's just a bizarre make-believe that is still going on, and they refuse to face facts, which is that they are diminishing. At the same time, Tom Cruise's star profile is only rising, which is extraordinary, given he's like was one of the big 80s movie stars. The others are sort of chilling out a bit now. He's like, you know, Tom Hanks and whoever else. And Tom Cruise is just going for it into the stratosphere. And he's taking larger and larger percentages of the sort of the production money and the production roles in all of his films. He is now like, he is Hollywood, basically, in many respects. And it's an interesting one, because there was a South Park, the famous South Park in the early 2000s about Scientology and Tom Cruise and all of that. And they had this really controversial poster for it, which said, "Jews, tell them who really runs Hollywood," because the implication it's you know, Scientology does. And they very much do now more than ever through Tom Cruise. If nothing more than as a vehicle for Tom, because it's a vehicle for Scientology, because every movie he does shows him with superhuman strength, sometimes being able to live different lives, come back in another life. They all show him as a sort of promotional material for Scientology. And that is just growing and growing. So the PR side has become more subtle in that sense, because it used to be him coming out and jumping on sofas and things. Yeah. And they are growing in quite an insidious way. But the Scientology itself is losing power. And a big part of that, as you allude to, is the loss of being able to keep hold of their secrets. WikiLeaks actually were the ones, the Julian Assange guys, who I think first in any kind of major way leaked the backstory, the origin story of Scientology. And then South Park did it in a very mainstream way. You're not supposed to know about that in Scientology until you reach Operating Thetan Level 3, which is when you're hundreds of thousands of dollars down the line. But firstly, it's that boiling frog concept, because nobody would believe the bonkers story about Lord Xenu, overpopulation, throwing people in volcanoes. It's just utter nonsense. Nobody would believe that if you just approach them with that, but they have to slowly be sort of infiltrated and slowly sort of pushed in that direction. It doesn't work if you've just read about it on WikiLeaks or seen the South Park episode. A lot of people left Scientology or weren't sure, and then they watched the South Park and they went, oh God. So without having secrets to dangle over people's head and say, and promises of if you reach the next level, we'll tell you a little bit more, they have lost a lot of power. And that is the true power of secrecy.
Well, that's a perfect note to finish up on. Thank you so much, Andrew. I could talk to you for another 5 hours, but I will let you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So, I highly recommend the book, and congratulations on it. It's a great read.
Oh, thank
you. It really is. And it's fascinating.
I hope people get it. And they can get, by the way, they can get a signed copy from a bookshop called Toppings. But the thing is that the sending, the packaging and stuff is bloody expensive if it's going to Australia and all that. But otherwise, you can get it now on the UK Amazon. And then it comes out in America, I think. I mean, I don't know about Australia, but in September. But most people in Australia and America have just got it on amazon.co.uk. And then you can just send it over from there. So, I hope people, if you know what, put a review after and say you first heard about it on Shauna's show, because I'm always interested to know. Yeah, that would be cool to know. So do that, put it on Amazon, and we'll see what's what.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Shauna. Guys, I hope you really enjoyed that. That was the Vintage Read Show. She does a lot of stuff, Shauna, about books and royals and gossip and things going on. So go check her out. Go subscribe to the Vintage Read Show. That is Shauna. And please do get hold of my book, The Psychology of Secrets, My Adventures with Murderers, Cults and Influencers, and give it a nice review on Goodreads and on Amazon.co.uk. Let me know what you think. If you're on Spotify, you can leave a little comment nowadays, I think. Well, I know you can because I've seen them, but I don't know how you do it, but I've seen the comments and I read all the comments, I read all the reviews, and well, I've got nothing more to say to you except I bid you a good weekend. I'll see you next time.